Coming to you live from the basement of an abandoned training facility, where we talk about fighting, training, and events. It's the Fight Mixer Show, where you can hear about all the local and world combat sports happenings. Get ready. It's time to gear up and square up, because we're going live on the Fight Mixer Show.
Welcome, boys and girls, to another edition of the Fight Mixer. We are here live. I am so honored to talk to the man who is a part of the tournament that started it all. UFC 1 veteran, MMA veteran, Mr. Zane Frazier. What's going on, brother?
Hey, how you guys doing, guys? Thanks for having me on.
Great to be with you. And what have you been up to, guys?
Well, you know, I own a title boxing club franchise. I've been working that and working our way of getting through the pandemic, that kind of thing, keeping my staff employed. So I've been doing that for like the last 4 years. Prior to that, I had a couple boxing studios, private training studios for certain, I'd say a specific clientele, working corporate wellness for a while. I have a program which is called martial arts cross training. And in that program is various different types of martial arts and training and fitness and sports performance related to martial arts training. And I put those services together in kind of use that as a platform or vehicle, if you will, for human development. And I then work with companies that want to do team building exercises. So facilities that will already have either gym or fitness facility or a want to invest in the gym for their employees. And then I go there and I teach boxing, kickboxing, martial arts, MMA, karate, or kempo, things like that, women's self-defense, cross-training programs designed to help not just get their physical bodies, but their mental bodies, but their spiritual side, as well as the emotional side as it relates to fitness. So give them a complete fitness background. So that's kind of essentially what I've been doing for the last, 14 years now.
It's so crazy because when I was telling people that you're going to be on the show and on the program, immediately people were like, you got to ask about UFC 1. And, you know, I just want to go a little bit backwards before UFC 1. Because The original concept of the UFC was just such an insane idea, especially I think that's what they were selling to people. Like, this was going to be no holds barred, anything goes. You know, you can win by KO, submission, death. Like, it was such an insane idea, but it had to be completely different for you being a competitor in this first tournament. So how did you get tapped on the shoulder to participate in this event, and how were you sold on the idea of participating in this event?
Well, let's go back a little further back when I was in college. I got in a fight with a bunch of football players over a girl, which I wound up marrying, right? And I got the crap beat out of me. I was 18 years old. And so I go into the local, and I'm in Moscow, Idaho, went to the University of Idaho at the time. And so I went into the local martial arts studio, and I told him I wanted to be the best street fighter in the world. And he asked me what happened. Did I get beat up? I go, yeah. So he starts laughing. And so I told him back then, I said, I want to be the best street fighter in the world. And he was a very progressive thinking guy back then. And so he said, well, if you want to learn how to do street fighting, there is a fighting system called Tai Kempo, which was Tactical Arts Incorporated or Transitional Arts Incorporated. And it was one of the Kempo systems, offshoots of Ed Parker's Kempo, that had Pankration, which is another form of MMA, which is the first MMA program wrapped inside of the karate and the kung fu and the boxing, kickboxing. It wasn't called kickboxing. It was called full contact karate then. And grappling arts. And that wasn't grappling as jujitsu as we know it. It was more like finishing holds. So a lot of the grappling techniques we had were finishing holds that were designed to finish fights and choke an opponent, things like that. So that system had, I was involved in training in that system. So I started competing, different things like that. When I moved back to Los Angeles, California, I started training with the Kempo guys, start winning tournaments, won kickboxing championships and karate championships. And so my instructor at the time, Frank Trail, who was the senior Ed Parker's top guy, and he was the fighting coach for the Ed Parker Kempo karate system. Himself was a boxer, a pro boxer, things like that. He was always about the fighting side of Kempo. Everybody looks at the karate side and the techniques, and everybody doing multiple techniques. But there is a fighting side of Kempo that a lot of people aren't aware of. And that's where I started training in the fighting style of Kempo. And my instructor created Kempo fighters, not just Kempo karate people. Why that's important is because Horion Gracie had saw me fight at the internationals in 1982. I think it was the summer. Yeah, it was August of 1982. And I was fighting a guy named Woody Sims. And Woody and I used to have some great battles. But this particular battle came out into a street fight. And I wound up taking him down and whatnot. It's called ground and pound. Now we just call it knee on the chest and just beat the snot out of him and put him unconscious. They had to wheel him out of a wheelchair. I was just about to get arrested by the L.A. County Sheriff Department. And they was escorting me out of the building. And then Horion Gracie put his arm around me and said, hey, come follow me. And so he took me and Horion hit me in his booth. And so he put some videotapes in, which was the Gracie in Action tapes where they were doing Vale Tudo down in Brazil, which come to find out, I didn't know what Vale Tudo was. Yeah. And so Horion Gracie said, man, you're a great fighter. Asked my name, so forth and so on, what style am I? Tom Kempo karate and things like that. And he goes, do you want to fight in a fight like this? And he was showing me the videotapes. And I go, yeah, man, I'd love to do that. He goes, where do you have those fights? And he goes, we have them in Brazil. I said, man, I don't need money to fly to Brazil. He goes, don't worry, I'll fly you down there. I says, really? Yeah. I says, where would I stay? I don't have any place to stay. He goes, don't worry about it. I'll put you in a hotel. And I said, wow. He goes, and I'll pay you $1,000.
What?
And I was back then, man, $1,000, man. Shoot, man, $1,000 one fight? We were like, gotcha. Jackpot, man. I'm in. And then Horion said, you don't have to worry about it. Going to Brazil, I says, why? He says, because we're going to bring this fight. We're going to bring this type of fight into the U.S. And I says, you got to be kidding me, man. I just got disqualified in a karate term for beating the snot out of a guy. And you tell me we're going to go no holds barred? So about, I think it was January of 93, I get a call from my instructor, Frank Trail. And he goes, hey, Horion Gracie just put out this fight. And he wants the top fighters in all these martial arts disciplines. And he wanted to find out who the top fighter in Kempo karate was. And they said, well, everybody talked about was Zane Frazier at the time. And so he said, okay, well, we're going to get Zane Frazier. And so they called me and asked me to be in the fight. I go, heck yeah. So I had already been training in that mentality. In fact, in college, I was in college with Dan O'Brien, who's one of the greatest decathletes of all time. He was my dorm mate. And we would, and this is in the early 80s, and so we would be training with, I had a catcher's mask, a catcher's chest protector, and groin protector. I borrowed a girdle for the football pants with thigh pads and groin cup and shin guards and elbow volleyball elbow pads and knee pads. And we would be sparring like this in the dorm, pretending like, you know, what happens in a street fight, because I got in a fight with a dorm and the dorm was very narrow. So I couldn't, there was no way for me to go. So I started to recreate the situation on what happens if that happens to me again. So we were having these sparring matches in the dorms with all this gear on. And Dan O'Brien was like, what are you guys doing? I said, man, we're training. We're training for full contact fighting. He goes, who fights like this? Nobody fights like this. This is crazy. And so I says, we're learning to fight like this. He goes, nobody fights like this. And I said, well, we're going to be the first ones to learn how to fight like this. So that's how we started training. That was going all the way back to the early 80s. So by the time UFC 1 came around in 93, I was waiting for it. I was prepared for it because we knew fighting had to change, because it wasn't a lot of kickboxing fights for a lot of heavyweights. There were so many heavyweights, you couldn't get a lot of fights. Tournament karate was starting to get watered down. Boxing events were more, you had to be strictly boxing. And it was just no opportunities at that time. So eventually we knew that something was going to change, and eventually it did. And that's when the UFC came in.
I think that's why everybody was so drawn to this sports event, because my household was a Mike Tyson loving household, and this was around the time when, and I just want to welcome my trip, everybody, back to 1993, 1994, around that area, because Mike Tyson was going to prison. He was a top draw in boxing, and also in WWE, we were a WWE loving household for wrestling, and that's when the massive steroid trial happened. So WWE was on the fritz as well, and you know, boxing was on the decline, pro wrestling was on the decline. So obviously, America had this hunger and need for this new type of sport. So it gave the perfect, you know, entry and the perfect way for UFC to come about and make some noise. And I was always under the misconception, like I had always the conception where UFC 1 was, it seemed like it was the big infomercial for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, where Royce Gracie was set up for success, where nobody really had ground game, but you had a ground game. You actually trained in Brazil.
Well, not before. I didn't train Brazil before that, but you know, we all were. If you needed ground fighting techniques, and you're in California, I was training with the Kempo guys. I was training with Sensei Benedict Urquidez, a lot of other great karate masters at the time. But if you wanted ground game, and everybody went to Gene LaBelle. Gene LaBelle was the go-to guy. Gene LaBelle was the go-to guy. He's been the go-to guy since, you know, Bruce Lee days, right? You know, because that's where Bruce Lee got his ground game from. So if you needed ground fighting or wrestling or grappling, stuff like that, Gene LaBelle was the guy you went to. So a lot of why I mentioned that, because a lot of black belts who were my instructors all trained with Gene LaBelle, the Chuck Norris, Cecil Peoples, Sensei Benedict Urquidez, Bill Rosaki. Ed Parker had a background in judo and freestyle wrestling and Greco-Roman wrestling. He incorporated that in that. In the Kempo system as well. So a lot of guys, a lot of systems, there was a guy named Jim Harrison. Jim Harrison was a great karate guy, but he was also a better judo guy. There was a kung fu guy named John Funk. John Funk was a kung fu guy, but he was also a judo guy. So a lot of the systems back then required grappling, judo, and submission techniques to get your black belt. So that was incorporated in your martial arts system, so made you more of a complete martial artists, and made you initiated to the fact that fights start up standing up, but you also got to learn how to finish them. And again, it's not like putting people in the guard and things like that. It was merely more of your escapes and how to get somebody in a bad spot and kind of what we now call ground and pound, beat them up and then choke. And back then it wasn't chokes. Everything was a break. You know, if you got a guy in I was down in Brazil once, and I was in a training with jiu-jitsu school, and those are things where they tap on the catch, meaning when you're grappling with somebody, gets a catch on you, you tap immediately, right? And the reason you did that, because if you didn't respect the catch, you know, then what happens is they went in full motion and broke it. See, everybody, they do a kind of a slow grapple where you kind of tap. And then obviously it depends on where you grapple and where you're rolling with. But a lot of times some people, they'll get a catch and just turn it and break it, right? They'll break the arm, they'll break the leg, and the shoulder. And I go, man, you're going hard. And nope, that's the way that was supposed to be taught. You remember, jiu-jitsu was the more aggressive style of submission wrestling. Judo was the gentle way, right? So people forget that's how it was taught back then. So we were taught it that way. We were taught that they were finishing holds. They weren't submission holds. That we weren't trying to get you to submit, because why? We didn't fight with rules that allowed you to go to the ground and tap people out. The ground fighting was designed to finish a fight, right? So that's kind of how we were talking about doing it. So I had some wrestling background. I've always were hanging around wrestlers in college. And after I get beat up by a bunch of football players, who usually when you encounter football players, chances are most of those guys, if not all of the guys, especially in the smaller towns in Northwest and in the Northern Plains and Midwest, usually have a wrestling background. They were wrestlers first. So we had a combat room at the University of Idaho, and all the football players would get together and wrestle. So that's why I started learning how to wrestle. And then we started using moves off the WWE. So my favorite guy was Curt Hennig, Mr. Perfect. So we used to try the moves we see on the WWE and incorporate them into our martial arts training to see if they'd work. And if this one worked, that worked. How do you set this up? How do you set that up? So that's how we all start making the transition. We just start watching the WWE and say, well, I wonder if that works. I wonder if this works. I wonder if that works. You know. So that's kind of how we started playing with stuff like that.
So, and you talk about Doodle Dean LaBelle, like, if you're going to learn from anybody, Doodle Dean LaBelle was doing these type of fights, style versus style fights back in the 50s and the 60s. I mean, he was eating boxers alive. One of the highly publicized fights was him versus a boxer. I mean, like, I want to go to UFC where, you know, the first fight, and Ken Shamrock was actually on the show, the first fight, Kelly Tua gets his teeth knocked out. And Ken Shamrock was like, holy crap, what did I just get myself into? And you were the next fight after that.
Right.
Taking back to that young man, that young warrior, backstage, you're going to be following up that where the teeth get knocked right into the commentating booth. Like, what was your mind frame coming out behind that curtain and walking out in the first fight?
Well, you got to keep in mind, let's go back the night before the fight. Remember, the Gracies changed the rules the night before the fight.
Right.
And the Gracies changed the rules the night before the fight because the way I was training to fight, I had to figure out if I was going to fight the Gracies, right? If I was going to fight, because I had seen them fight on videotape for almost, you know, 6 months now, right? So I kind of got an idea. Well, actually, by that time, it's a year by the time the UFC comes around. I've been studying the Gracie in action on Valley Tudo tapes and then working, trying to find guys that we could spar like that. So we were kind of playing around with those ideas at the time. You know, training with those, how do you fight against this? How do you fight against, what is their main move? And their main move was to take you down, get on top of you, beat you down, make you turn your back and choke, right? So we were figuring out, how do we stop the takedown? How do we stop the double leg? And what do we do from there? So I had a strategy that was going into the fight. And one of the strategies was to take people down and then, you know, hold their knees open, like with, if they had a gi or pin their knees open, and knee the groin. Remember, there's supposed to be no rules, right? There's only three rules: no biting, no fish hooking, and no eye gouging. The groin was supposed to be a legal target. So my strategy was really to fight the Gracies that way or Ken Shamrock that way, right? So I was used to fighting in the street, you know, doing my bouncer days at the nightclub and my bodyguard days. You know, we were fighting like that in the street in Hollywood Boulevard, getting shot at. So that stuff was new to me. That stuff wasn't new to me. That was something I put myself in harm's way in a lot of the bouncer bars back in college. I'd be the only white guy in 600 miles working in a nightclub. And I wanted to find out if my martial arts training would work. So I'd always been practicing and fighting as a bouncer to find kind of, I was kind of, they tell me I'm the first Patrick Swayze. I was the real Dalton, right? Because I was doing that long before that movie came out. So I was practicing that and practicing the martial arts and then refining them to how do you take it from the dojo, from the ring into the street, and how do you apply it, and can you teach it like that, right? So fast forward all the way to the night before the fight, the Gracies changed the night rules before the fight. So I challenged Horian to a fight right then and there. So I told Horian, I said, I'll fight Hoist's punk ass first, and then you'll be next. And I said, we can get it on right here, right now. So when I walked out into that fight that night, the next fight, I've heard Ken say, like, you know, what's going on? I get myself into, that was his attitude. My attitude was, I'm coming here to kill somebody. I'm coming here to really jack somebody up because that's what I do. This is what Kempo was made for, right? This is what Kempo fighters were for. So I came in there with that attitude. I came in there from the week prior to the fight. I came in with that attitude. I wasn't scared. I seen all these kind of fighters before. The guys that were in UFC 1 represented their styles, but if you look at Gerard Gardeau and Kevin Rozier, Art Jemison, I've been training and sparring with guys that were of a higher quality than that. Taylor Tully, was he a big guy? I knew some small guys I used to wrestle around with, so I kind of figured that out. The only guy that hadn't figured out was Ken Shamrock, because Ken had really some slick ground moves with leg locks, but at that time I had ran into Eric Paulson, and Eric Paulson, from since a year in Nakamura, I started to learn a lot of the leg locks and counters to that stuff. So I kind of had an idea of what not to do so Ken doesn't grab a leg. But from that standpoint, I was ready to go to war, man. I was not sitting around here messing around. I've trained like this since 1981, 82, and now I'm ready to go to war. And now it's finally here, and they're going to pay me for it. I'm ready to go, man. I mean, that wasn't scared at all. That's just who I am as a fighter and as a person. I've always had that mentality. So when I walked in UFC 1, I was ready to go, man. Day one.
And you made history right after UFC 1, where you landed in Shudo, I think it was like a year or two after UFC 1, and you actually won in like 30 seconds. Like, you killed this guy. I've seen the fight, but I can't recall when and where I seen the fight, but knocking out in like 30 seconds. And Shudo, by the way, Shudo is the first promotion that started, actually the big time promotion. That started in 1986. UFC started in 1993. And around that time, too, UFC was having problems where it started landing on the desks of senators and everything like that. And between you and I, I'd rather have headwear than have like senators on my ass, you know. Like, and they were really after the UFC. And you know, while you were in Shudo, you won that fight, big win. And you know, Japan, you know, later down the road with Pride and everything like that, Japan would build up momentum from Pancras and from Shudo and going to the Pride, where the MMA boom happened in Japan way before it happened in the UFC, because UFC was in the process of going through its dark days right around 95, 96 when John McCain was trying to get it shut down. But where did UFC start running the problems? Is it the marketing?
You're right. So you got to keep in mind two things. The marketing for UFC 1 was about, it was called it, you know, they had some marketing promotions. I think they labeled it a death match. There was some marketing promotions, the first real death match or something like that. And I think that caught some media's attention. I think they stopped promoting it that way at that time. But really what happened is that, when you go to UFC 2, I think the fight that you kind of people got to look at is the most that when people finally call on after UFC 1, right? Then UFC 2 comes out. And I want to say UFC 2 comes out in February of 94, I think it is. I want to say, I'm not sure. I think it was February of 94. And Patrick Smith fights Scott Morris. He's I think he was a ninja guy. And then Pat gets mounted on Scott Morris and starts elbowing him to oblivion. That's when everybody got terrified from a political standpoint, because nobody had seen that. You got to remember, you know, you got to ask yourself a question. There's a lot of guys, a lot of great fighters. With Mike Tyson, being not available, I'll just say not available, because I'm a Mike Tyson fan. I hate to say he was in jail, because you know, I got some opinions on that, but nobody else stepped up to fight in the UFC. Fighters, boxers, kickboxers, all the guys in the K-1, no one stepped up, right? Probably Jerome LeBanner, those guys did. Maybe Sam Greco did a couple fights, right? So you got to remember that UFC not just scared politicians, it scared fighters throughout the world that this was here. And if you are some kind of champion, you are some kind of black belt, give Horion Gracie and Art Davey a call and step into it. And if you weren't that guy, then you weren't that guy, right? So because all you had to do, you was a phone call away from calling and say, hey, I want to get into the UFC. So that shook a lot of martial arts schools, systems, instructors, and shook the foundation of what everybody was doing as far as martial arts fighting at the time. Then it shook the boxing community, because you got to remember Senator McCain, I believe, he was the one that was spearheading that. But you got to remember Budweiser was behind all that, the boxing too. So you're taking away revenue from Budweiser, you know, and I think he had, I think that there might have been some connection there that was somebody with Budweiser didn't want the UFC going around. They didn't want that to keep going on. So it was pressuring Senator McCain to kind of stop the UFC. It was barbaric, stuff like that. So that was the one. But the critical one was, I believe, UFC 9. When I fought in UFC 9, the UFC was still in federal court. Everybody wants to know why, you know, Dan Severn and Ken Shamrock were just standing around. Well, they're not doing it well because the fight, they were still in federal court. It was illegal to throw punches in that fight, even though some people did headbutts. I received a warrant for my arrest going into the cage to fight Cal Worsham. A captain for the Detroit Police Department at the time stood right there and told me if I threw one punch with a closed fist, I was going to jail. And so we didn't know what to do. And I said, well, how come he doesn't get the same rules? And they said, we don't care about that. You do what we tell you. Here's a warrant for your arrest. And he had it right there. My name was on it. So they were still in federal court trying to get the rules passed at UFC 9 during the event, right? So everything started to, and by the time you get to Don Fry's fight with Armin Pitesh, and you start to see that fight, that was the fight that kind of changed the UFC, in my opinion, or MMA, because now you had Don Fry, Mark Coleman, Mark Kerr, all of those guys, Tom Erickson, Van Arsdale. You had a lot of great, you had all of those, that wrestling team and Team Phoenix, which is why I left LA to join Team Phoenix, because those guys were beating everybody, they were undefeated. And that fight right there, and those fighters there, was the one that shook up the UFC, that convinced people this was too brutal. And here's why, because most karate fighters, martial arts fighters, kickboxing fighters weren't capable at the time to deal with all the wrestlers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that put them in harm's way, because Mark Coleman and Kerr and Don Fry, Dan Severn, those guys are coming, man. And so that was a challenge in itself. And I think that's where the brutality came in, which they call the shark goldfish mentality. You had these sharks in there with a bunch of goldfish, and it looked great for TV. But then somebody said, you know, from a political standpoint, this isn't right.
Exactly.
So they were trying to put a stop to the UFC at that point.
And what I found it very ironic, even at a young age, is Don Coleman was so against it, but he was also at a fight where a boxer died. So, like, while he was so against it, in 1996, he was like, oh, well, it's too barbaric and everything, but he was actually at a fight where a boxer dropped dead. And actually
right. Died in
1996 or 1997. But, like, fast forward a little bit, where, you know, towards 2001, I think he fought for a fight against Giant Oakley, which Giant Oakley was a wrestler. Yeah. 2001, Zuffa buys the UFC. Now they're trying to remarket, rebrand it. They're trying to change the rules. Did you ever entertain the idea of possibly going into Pride, possibly going to the UFC? Like, you were fighting all over the place at that time in the 90s when Zuffa bought out the UFC and changed up the rules to make it safe, or more safe, rather. Did you ever entertain the idea of going back, or going back to the UFC, or possibly fighting in Pride when the MMA boom was happening?
So one of the things, one of the fighters that never had a manager. I never had a manager. I was always Zane Frazier training, Zane Frazier conditioning, and Zane Frazier make a call to a fight organization and say, hey, man, I'm ready to go. Well, what club are you at? Well, Arizona really didn't have any clubs. Outside of Richard Hamilton, that he wound up going to jail, he was the coach here. And a lot of the guys who are the head coach, like Trevor Lally, Arizona Combat Sports, those guys are just getting their feet wet. There was no coaches here. And I just moved here from L.A., and I wasn't going to move back to L.A. because there was nothing really there in L.A. for me at the time. So I called Joe Silva up at least 25 times to get back in the UFC, and Joe Silva told me no. And I said, why, Joe? I'm ready. I'm in shape. And then something I'm reminded, this is something that Mark Kerr told me. So when I got here, I spent 15 years on the mat with wrestlers. I'm talking the best of the best wrestlers. And for 7 years, I couldn't get a takedown. I got my ass handed to me every day. And I mean, we're wrestling 7 days a week, and I got my ass handed to me by wrestlers every single day. And it took me about 8 years before I can score a takedown on a wrestler. And I'm talking, again, world-class wrestlers. So when I finally get my wrestling skills up, I'm training with Melvin Douglas privately 7 days a week. We're doing three-hour day. We're doing three-hour workouts every day, 7 days a week. Finally get my wrestling to the point that I'm ready to go. And me and Mark Kerr, we wrestle, and I take Mark Kerr down a couple times. And then we're going back and forth, scrambling. He couldn't get me. I couldn't get him. And finally got me once. And so anyway, Ref Mark Kerr told me, Zane, now that your wrestling is up to speed, which is great, here's going to be your biggest problem. You're never going to get another fight. So when I was trying to get over to the UFC, Joe Silva turned me down many times. I was saying, we need to have you with a camp. I says, hey, man, I just won my last fight. I'm with this guy. I need to get a fight. Joe Silva turned me. I called Joe Silva at least 25 times, and Joe Silva never put me back in the UFC. So that was it. I called Monty Cox. Hey, Monty Cox, can I fight Tim Sylvia? Monty Cox, man, Zane, we're never going to fight you, man. We're going to fight you when you're 60 years old. So I tried to get at Pride, had no connections to get over to Pride at all. I said, who do you contact to get over to Pride? And at the time, if you know those Japanese organizations, those are people you have to know. So I was trying to get over to Japan. I'm trying to get over here. I'm trying to fight. And it was by the time I'm getting fights in Brazil and little stuff right here and there, just little small things, not small things, but fighting an abstract, not with an organization. And so when I was trying to get in with Mark Kerr and those guys, that was just you had to know the right people to get in at the time to get in with Pride and those guys. And I didn't have the connections to get in there. So all I did was say, you know, I'll keep training. I'll wait for my opportunity to come. And that's kind of how, you know, my kind of career kind of went at that point. You know, I was kind of working on that. But the other thing was I was working on a deal that I got funded. Was $125 million health club, and I got some group of investors together, and I had been working on that for about 7 years, and then that came to fruition, and then the economy collapsed 2 days before we were going to get funded. So that was a big chunk of my time because that was something I wanted to do, but I had been working on for quite some time. So I started to work on those things because what I didn't want to do is be a guy that fought in early days but have nothing to fall back on, right? So that's kind of why I was into the fitness. I was working on getting my own fitness franchise, which, you know, I finally have secured that because I finally got the franchise that I wanted. Because the industry changed even after the recession. So that's kind of a lot of how my career went. But I kind of knew something way back in 94, and I started to realize that the UFC was going to change, the fighting was going to change. So December 94, I started to plan my comeback. I said, you know what? And somebody asked me, why were you planning to come back then? Because Ron Van Cleef had fought Royce Gracie, and I had trained with Ron Van Cleef. Ron Van Cleef was a great, you know, the Black Dragon kind of movie guy, and I trained with him. Yeah. And Ron Van Cleef had made a comment in that fight when he was fighting Royce Gracie. He goes, I've been fighting for 20 years, and these guys don't know all the martial arts I knew. It was at that moment, at that time, that I knew the UFC was going to evolve. So what I decided was, because we saw this happen in kickboxing, so I said, I'm going to go where the industry is going to be in 20 years, and I'll wait for my opportunity then, because at that time, guess what? I'll still be young. I ain't banged up. I ain't got beat up. I'll get a fight. If I don't get a fight, I'll be ready for it. So for me, that's kind of how it went. It was more of a journey of being able to prove my skills more than kind of win a belt, because I just want to fight who's the best guy in the world. Like, I see some of these guys today in the UFC, and I'm thinking there's a lot of things that they could have evolved to, and I just don't understand why they're not. So when I look at a lot of fighters today, no criticism to them, but a lot of guys haven't evolved in a way that I thought they would evolve that would make it to the point where, like you see the NBA, you see Michael Jordan and Kobe, and now you see the NBA today. You got a lot of guys who got the Kobe skills and Michael skills and things like that. And so it's very hard for somebody back in the day to compete with these guys today. But the UFC is not like that. The guys in the heavyweight division, who do you have that makes a standout, right? So I said to myself 20 years ago, I'm going to go train, and eventually the sport's going to change. And this is why I like what Jake Paul did and Logan Paul, because now you're going to have challenge matches. Now you're going to have to fight somebody, right? See, because now you can call people out. That's what needed to happen, right? Because when I called Joe Silva told me, I ain't letting you beat up these guys, these young guys. We're trying to build a company. You're an old guy, this and that. And I wasn't even that old. I was like in my mid-30s. And I couldn't get a fight. I could UFC, and I never could get to Dana White. And then finally, I went to Dana White called me. And we was flying a lot of the guys. The UFC went out, and I told Dana White, hey, I want to come back to UFC at some point. But I'll let you know when I want to return. And he goes, absolutely. And that was some years ago. But I'd always felt that there was going to be a time and place for me to do what I want to do because of the fact that I wanted to evolve. It's more, the UFC is more than just fighting and winning for belt. To me, it's about being able to develop as a martial artist and still prove your skills. Are your skills good today like they were yesterday? Right? Because when I look at Royce, and I'm a fan of Royce Gracie, because when I started to really study Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I understood the mentality of the Gracies. And the mentality people forget. And I had this conversation with Hickson Gracie before I finally left to go to Arizona. I went and had a 3-hour conversation with Hickson Gracie and asked Hickson, would he train me? Hickson said, I can't train you, but let's have a conversation. And we sat in the studio and we just talked about martial arts and jiu-jitsu. And long story short, what I learned from that interview, that conversation with Hickson, that jiu-jitsu isn't a style, it isn't submission, it isn't the triangle choke, it isn't the guard, it is none of it. It is those things, yes, for sure. But jujitsu is the way they fight with it. They use the mentality is the difference. And that's kind of what I started to learn and started the mentality of the Brazilians, because they were the only ones that had that type of mentality who have been fighting with those type of rules for quite some time, right? Yeah. So that's kind of what I started to do, is just say, hey, you know what? I'm a lifelong martial arts guy. I'm going to train and train and train. Eventually, I'll get a shot back. I'll return back. We'll just have to figure out the right time, the right place, right opponent.
I think the fundamental difference, too, and you brought up the Paul brothers and everything like that, where it's as easy, you can build up a money fight just click on the button and calling out somebody on Instagram. But the fundamental difference between nowadays and this generation of fighters and your generation is you guys did it for the love of the sport, the love of being a competitor, the love of evolving into a complete martial arts and fighting the best of the best. And going on that subject, and of course, you know, talking to a legend yourself and talking to somebody, again, that tournament helped shape the foundation of what the UFC is today. And what was your most memorable fight? I thought your fight was Brian Oche, because I was a Brian Oche fan for his fight at 5'10 versus Rico Rodriguez. And that was your win over Brian Oche was one of my favorite fights, King of the Cage. But in your opinion, throughout your entire career, what was your most memorable fight?
Memorable fight. There was a lot of fights I had that weren't counted, right, on the Sure Dog record because they were considered illegal fights. So there's about 20 some odd fights that I've had. Like my record shows like 4 and 11. I said, that's ridiculous because I had more fights than that, because at the time, a lot of those fights were underground. They were in Mexico. They were in down south. And Buddy Albin did a bunch of fights and stuff like that. So those fights aren't considered real fights, right? Those aren't considered the real fights. So I would have to say, the fights, I don't know if I have a fight that is my most considerable fight, my most memorable fight, because a lot of times where I went to fight, I also was training with people, and I would train all that week, because you got to remember something, people don't realize, back in the day when I was coming, there was no MMA sparring, right? Where do you go get MMA sparring from? Judo guys weren't MMA sparring. The Gracies were only sparring with their group of people, and they weren't doing Vale Tudo sparring. I remember going to Victor Belfort's studio one time, and Victor Belfort was in Santa Monica above the Nike store on right there on Santa Monica. I forget the other street. And he wasn't doing MMA sparring or Vale Tudo sparring. Ken Gableson, those guys who came from Mixon, they weren't sparring. There was no sparring. So when you had to go to a fight, your fight was the sparring. That was how you sparred. That's how I sparred to get in shape. And then when you try to put the gear on and say, okay, let's go punch, kick, knee, elbow, ground, and pound and fight, there was none of that. Nobody was doing that. You'd either put your boxing together, you put your kickboxing together, your Muay Thai together, your ground and pound get together. But it wasn't like it is today. And I think probably Chuck Liddell and Tito Ortiz and Frank Shamrock and those guys were the guys who probably, and I think maybe Ken had started to evolve to, and no Eric Paulson for sure, where you would actually punch, kick, grapple, and wrestle and stuff like that, where you could train like that. So I don't know if I have a memorable fight because I'm still, my heart is still in fighting. I think I have so my point with that is that my greatest fight memory is yet to come, I believe. Right. So for the most part, I just had a lot of great experiences, learning experiences of learning from different martial arts. That's what I love most about, is going to different places and learning as you're going through these events. You know, for example, UFC 1, I would say UFC 1 was interesting because when I finally got a chance to see what Hoist was able to do. Right. So, you know, and there was a whole thing between me and the Graces, and the after party was a great thing. You know, we all got together and sat down and had great conversations, right? So Hoist and I wound up in the elevator at the same time. Now, there's about 170 Gracie first cousins that are, like, running security. They got all black on and beanies. And these guys look like they were straight out of South Central somewhere, right? So Hoist and I went, it was like there was a bunch of them, man. So Hoist and I wound up in the same elevator, And I broke the silence and said, Hoist, man, I love the jujitsu and stuff like that. And so all of these guys come running to the elevator, but the elevator door is closed. So I have a couple of 7-Up on me, you know, and I always nerd, you know, have an ink pen on me, something like that, because I'm always taking notes about martial arts. So anyway, Hoist Gracie proceeds to give me a private lesson in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the elevator.
Wow.
And I'm writing notes down, right? Okay, you call this the guard. Why do you call it the guard? Well, this is the mount. This is the hip escape. Why do you call it? This is, what do you call this? What do you call that? So we're going up and down, and we're putting the alarm on and so we can stop. And we're in the elevator for about a good 15 minutes, right? And everybody's running up and down the stairs because they think of me and Hoist are in some big-ass fight, right? So, but I'm taking – Hoist is giving me a private jiu-jitsu lesson in the elevator. And I was – and then so – and I was going, and I said, Hoist. And so Hoist started showing me the intricacies of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, or Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, I should say. And I realized, man, that's some slick shit, man. I said, holy crap, I didn't know it was that intricate, man. And he goes, yeah. He goes, when I do this, and then you turn over. He said, okay, get on your, he got, you know, what we call quarter position wrestling. He got his hooks in. We call these hooks. We straighten you out, okay? We lock your legs out. Now I'm going to hit you, right? Now you're going to hit, you're going to turn your face, but now you turn your face into a choke. I said, oh, wow, now if you defend that, now I can roll you and put you in an arm bar. I said, what if I get up like this? Then he went to the triangle choke. Then I went to, and I tried to get out of the triangle choke, and then Hoist was able to secure another arm bar. And then he got a reverse arm bar, and then he wound up taking my back again. And so I'm taking all these notes down on a napkin, bro. I mean, this. So if I could say it was a great memory, it was my private lesson in Hoist Gracie in the elevator. And so finally we lose track of, because we were putting the alarm on so it stopped the elevator. So we lost track of what we were doing that. And I said, and I'm taking notes. And so I think the elevator finally opens up. I can't remember what floor it is. And then all of a sudden, Horion and his dad and Hickson and all those guys, they're all outside. And then Hoisin says in Portuguese, everything's fine and stuff like that. And Hoist, we hugged and stuff like that. And he gave me his Gracie Jiu-Jitsu hat. I still have it to this day. And I gave him a shirt, a Kempo Karate shirt. So if I have a great memory, it was that, because that's when I started to realize after UFC 1 that I need to go on a journey to learn more about valetudo fighting rules against skilled other fighters. And now I realize there's a discipline in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that I need to now understand. So when I started out on that journey, I'm the only guy in the history of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or in the world that was actually banned from studying Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Henzo Gracie wouldn't even let me buy videotapes. So Gene LaBelle walked me into the Gracies or to the Machado brothers and asked me to train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and they said, Gene, we can't, trains against the family. I go to Hickson. Hickson says no. Before that, I go to Horion. Horion says no. So I have my wife go in and buy some Jiu-Jitsu tapes, instructional tapes from Horion and Torrance, but they don't remember her. So she went out and we bought like $300 worth of tapes. So I'm studying the tapes. So then Craig Chupnik was a guy that was a Henzo Gracie black belt. I went to high school with him and played football with him, right? So I called him up and was going to buy some tapes for about $650. And then Henzo said no, so I couldn't even buy tapes. So it wasn't until I got to Brazil that I could actually study Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with somebody from Brazil, right? Wow. And so my point with that is that I started on this quest of where is the sport going to evolve, right? Because you have to think about it. Here's what I told Horion Gracie. I said, Horion Gracie, this is during the whole interview and the fight, the night before the fight. So Horion, you got a choice, and it's not a good choice for you. I said, if any one of us lose, it's okay, because guess what? We lost. Yeah. But if you guys lose, it's shame on you, right? So you guys have to win. So you set this up to win. But here's what I'm going to tell you. Either you lose tonight, either you put the challenge and let Hoist fight me first. Put the or Ken Shamrock first. Fight one of the other guys first, right? Or you guys are going to lose later, because the sport's going to evolve. Because one thing about Americans, I said to Horry, I said, one thing about Americans, if you go back even back to the Revolutionary War, the Americans are great at playing catch up. And eventually we will learn jiu-jitsu. We will learn how to do this. And what's going to happen, either you got to keep the secret of jiu-jitsu in the bag and you ain't going to make no money, or you have to let it out of the bag and you ain't going to be on top anymore. And now we're going to find out who the real fighter is. And that's why people ask me a lot of times, people say, hey man, how come there are no Gracie champions outside of Hoist in the UFC? Great question, right?
Yeah.
That was what I was telling Horia. No, great. I mean, think about it. All the Gracie, man, you got Hoist is the only one, the only champion, the right. only champion.
That's so fascinating, especially Hicks and Gracie. I think, you know, he was very choosy when it came to opponents. And then Enzo Gracie was a shining light for a while, and then Sakuraba with catch wrestling, and, you know, he was able to, you know, because Sakuraba actually put a lot of Gracie hopes and dreams for the next big star, the next big thing, the sleep. You know, he'd be high in Gracie, Enzo Gracie, you know, just going down the run, he beat so many Gracies. And I do have, before we let you go, and I can talk to you all night, but, you know, obviously I'm getting waved off and we're heading towards the end of the show, but I do have a two-part question. Sure. Being, you know, coaching now, being a mentor now, being one of the OGs of the game, and I cannot stress that enough, who's been through every generation of the sport, whether, you know, it's a grand opening, grand closing, grand opening, back from the dead again. You know, as a coach and as a mentor, what's the greatest advice that you give to your students that want to become an inspiring fighter? Like, say, hey, Mr. Frazier, Zane Frazier, how do I get into the sport? I want to be a fighter like you. I want to get into the UFC. And number two, did you ever see the UFC, going back to UFC 1, the young man that you were, the young fighter, hungry warrior that you were, did you ever see the UFC getting to where it is today, where it's a publicly traded company? You know, they're putting on fights on ESPN. You know, everybody's on the UFC bandwagon. You know, so two questions. One, what advice do you give to somebody that wants to break into the UFC and break into MMA and make it big? And two, did you ever see the UFC even making it this far?
Well, a couple things, yeah. So here's the first thing I tell kids, because I get people ask me, Zane Frazier, hey, Zane, when you come train me? I got a kid right now that I'm training, that I've trained with, and I started training him when he was 12. And the first thing I told him, I said, you're going to have to go to start wrestling. And so every kid that I train, at one time, I didn't keep my certification, but I got certified as a USA wrestling coach. And I would go down and help kids in coaching. ASU had I was the first guy to help start the adult MMA wrestling program, a wrestling MMA program at ASU, the Arizona State University. Then Bader, and then Cain Vasquez, and C.B. Dalloway, Jamie, all those guys came in later down. But it was designed to be able to take kids who were wrestlers and teach them how to punch and kick and how to transition between that. So the first thing I tell the kid right now, kid comes in, he goes, hey, I want to get in the UFC. I get kids tell me all the time, and I got karate kids. Here's what I'll tell them. I said, I don't know if you're tough enough, but here's how we're going to find out. I said, go to wrestling. Go to your high school, go to your junior high school, go wrestle for 1 year. And a minimum of 1 year. Wrestle 4 years if you can. Come see me in 4 years. And the reason why I say that is because if they don't make it through wrestling, I already know they're not going to be tough enough to deal with it. They're not going to do the work. Because one of the things that I realized in wrestling that I had to do, one of the things I did, I stopped punching, kicking, striking for 3 years just so I can develop my wrestling and become a wrestler. Not I am a wrestler. I had to become a wrestler. And I had to walk, talk, you know, all things like that, you know, think like them, move like them, train like them, believe like them. So that's my first thing to tell kids. The punching, kicking stuff, yeah, I can teach you that. That's great. But I want to see you go wrestle for a year. And when you go wrestle for a year, that's going to tell me what kind of character, what kind of heart you got. And so that's kind of the thing that that's my first advice to all the kids that people have come to me and say, I want to get into fighting. And I tell them the other thing too, you got to start young enough and you got to get around quality coaching early enough, because again, kids are too good now. You know, so that's the first thing I do. Get a quality, and I start kids in at 10 years old now. Why? Because by the time you're 15, it's too late. Because you got kids who have been wrestling for 5 years. So if you're behind the wrestling game, you got to catch up on it. That's the number one component that you need is a wrestling game. If you can't study Brazilian jiu-jitsu or jiu-jitsu or catch wrestling, submission wrestling, however you want to call it, complement that at the same time. You got to get those first 5 years underneath your belt. Simply because, second thing, you have to find a coach that's going to be able to teach you a martial arts system or a fighting system that is indicative of your physical attributes, meaning speed, size, quickness. For example, I see a lot of guys who do martial arts systems in the UFC when they fight, but someone has not developed their attributes for their striking game or their wrestling game. In other words, there's no transition. There's no continuity between their ground game or their wrestling game and their punching, kicking, striking. So there has to be a transition there that they have to develop that. And thirdly, they have to be able to discover what is their talents and what are their abilities, right? So when they discover what their talents and their abilities are, those also have to be trained cohesively with your attributes as well as the system and discipline. In other words, if you like Muay Thai and that's your flavor, right, you're going to be able to have to see what are your attributes, what's your physical athletic attributes that go along with becoming a great Muay Thai guy. Or you like karate, you like taekwondo, you like, you know, a lot of kempo guys getting in, all this stuff like that. Are you a point fighter? You have to be able to train all of those transitions. Those are the key things to be a great fighter. Not anybody can get in the UFC. Anybody can get in. You want to be a great fighter. You want to be the guy that has the belt around your waist. That's what you need to do. That's number one. Those are the things in the list there. When it comes down to your second question about seeing the UFC like it was, you got to keep in mind, Billy Blanks and I have been friends and we were training for a long time. And one of the things Billy Blanks and I sought out to do was make the health club industry and the world respect martial arts as a fitness workout, as a training program, and as a legitimate fighting sport. And the reason I say that is because when he did it through Taibo, you know, because I was teaching something called Karate Size before he was teaching Taibo, and then I got in cardio kickboxing. We called executive kickboxing back then. And so we were teaching it before Taibo came out. Billy's about 8, 9 years older than I am. And so when I fought in UFC 1, our goal was to force the American population, the world, to recognize the UFC and mixed martial arts. Now that we had arrived and we showed you what real fighting was, now we wanted to blow it up like the NBA, like NFL, like Major League Baseball, like soccer, had the flair of entertainment, you know, WWE, because I grew up in the WWF, same thing. And we needed it to grow like that. So it took somebody like a Dana White and the Fertitta brothers, Lorenzo and it took the Fertitta brothers to be able to put together the investment capital. And here's one of the clever things they did. They kept the UFC out of the hands of anybody from boxing who would have bought it, right? Because it was only for $2 million, right? Those guys would have bought the UFC and they would have killed it. So you right. got to give Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta the credit, and Dana White for keeping it out of boxing's hands. That's number one. Number two, put $94 million in it to make it run, right? And then three, blow it up to where it is. So we owe them that gratitude, because if not, everybody's still wondering, does karate work? Does kung fu work? Does martial arts really work? Now you got, you know, NFL players, soccer players, Major League Soccer players. You got all kind of athletes, Olympic athletes, using martial arts, mixed martial arts training to help them get better in their particular sport. And that's all because of the UFC and Dana White and all of the fighters that have come and have put the hard work in, put the training in, put on great fights, stuff like that. So that's what we wanted it to do. We wanted it to be like that. So I'm not surprised. I'm happy that it is. I think, in fact, it should be bigger, because I read an article the other day when they were talking about the Jake Paul, Logan Paul whole situation. And they said the UFC, I forget what article was, but it said the UFC was not a mainstream sport.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was. I forget what article was, but it was an article that came out about the Logan Paul and those guys. And in that article, it states that the UFC wasn't a major, wasn't a mainstream sport. And I was shocked when I read that, because I was saying to myself, what is it going to take for us to become a mainstream sport? Now, obviously, that's probably somebody's they're biased towards it. Obviously, we're a mainstream sport because, you know, look what we do as far. Look what Dana White, when I say we, look what the UFC and the MMA does as a sport, has changed the way martial arts is looked at in this world, on the world now, right? So we have to be a mainstream sport. So it was our hope that that the UFC becomes even bigger, it becomes, and I think mixed martial arts is going to have to become bigger, because one of the things I think is going to have to happen is that you're going to have to, somebody's going to come up at some point. I'm going to be the first one to say it. Somebody's going to come up and put, like that movie, The Warrior. You guys see The Warrior with, Okay. So The Warrior, where a guy, somebody puts up $10 million and said, let's find out who the best fighter in the world is. That's coming. Yeah. You know, Jake Paul and already, those guys have already set the stage for that. Somebody's going to put up $100 million, $200, whatever it's going to be. Winner takes all. For example, Francis Ngannou, he's a UFC heavyweight champion. Mm-hmm. You have all these other guys. You have Alexander Omega. You have all these guys that are heavyweight champions, some other organizations, guys you didn't even know, right?
Right.
All come together and put together a fight. Now, let's say, you know, Francis Ngannou doesn't win that fight, right? That doesn't mean he's not the UFC heavyweight champion. It just means he ain't the best champion in the world, right? So he's just not the best guy in the world. Why? Because he got beat by somebody who was better. So we're going to have to go back to what the Gracies did and start. And here's why I like what the Paul brothers did. Everybody who criticized the Paul brothers, if you criticize the Paul brothers, then you have to criticize the Gracies. Why? Because he did exactly what the Gracies did. They challenged the fight. They put it on, right? They didn't have one wrestler in that UFC one. And I called for a wrestler, by the way. I was the only guy saying, hey, we need to fight against a wrestler. Because to me, it was about how good am I when I'm pressured, when I'm getting my ass whipped, right? Mike Tyson wasn't the only one that had that mentality of what is it like when you're getting your ass whipped? Because I know it's like getting your ass whipped and you, all of a sudden you got to fight back. I get that, right? So what is it like when you're fighting another trained fighter who's skilled, who's tough, just like you, with a no-rules fight, right? So we have to be able to find that out. Now that we're commercialized, there are no more secrets anymore, right? There's no more. Everybody knows jiu-jitsu. Everybody knows Greco freestyle. Everybody knows this. Muay Thai. Everybody's got a chance for the last 28 years to study all the stuff that's out there. Now let's find out who the best guy is. So somebody dropped $10 million, $20 million, whatever it be, $100 million, whatever it might be, and put together a tournament, and let's find out who the baddest guy on the planet is. Yes. That's how I look at the sport. That's why I said I haven't had my memorable fight, because one of the things I'm planning to do training now is go travel around the world in different places and find out who's the best guy in the world. Who is it? Who is it? We don't know. We know who the UFC heavyweight champion. We get that's the biggest organization. But is that guy the best heavyweight or the best lightweight, best middleweight, light heavyweight? We don't know. So that's kind of how I look at it. So I think the sport, to answer your question, yes, I'm glad the UFC is big and it's huge and the platform is great, but now it's time to get bigger. Now it's time to get real. Because from now, because like I said, prior to UFC 1 and all the way now, we didn't know what we didn't know till now. Now we know what we know. Let's go find who the tough guy is.
Yeah.
And give us we need to make those fights.
Okay, exactly. And giving credit where credit is due, if not just Dana White, but if it wasn't for UFC 1 and it wasn't for that class of fighter, that tournament, I definitely believe that UFC wouldn't be as big as it is today. Like, you guys went into the ring with no rules, no mercy, chances of death, everything like that, was sanctioning body, get it out there, no rounds, everything like that. And you guys still went out there and fought and were essentially the guinea pigs, but you weren't the guinea pigs. You were laying the foundation for what the sport has become. So obviously you're a legend in your own right, and UFC 1 just proved that. And you were a part of the very first event. So
I appreciate that.
Not a problem, brother. And so, you know, I'll leave the floor to you for you know, where can we find you? Where can we get, you know, teaching from you? Where can we get coaching from you? Where can we find you on Instagram, Facebook? Where can we find you?
It's funny. I'm starting to finally get social media. I've been like, I follow everybody else on Instagram, right? I kind of look at that, and people have been telling me, Zane, you got to put your content on Instagram. So I'm starting to do that. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. I own the Title Boxing Club franchise on 32nd Street Indian School in Phoenix, Arizona. It's Arcadia. That's where you can find me primarily. I will start to lay some content out. One of my biggest things that I do in my title boxing franchise is I teach women's self-defense and anti-bullying self-defense, but I'm really about women's self-defense. My mom had 9 sisters, and I watched my mom beat a judo guy almost half to death when I was a kid. So I was taught how to fight early in the street. So my thing was about being able to teach women and girls how to fight. And that's what I kind of use my franchise to do, is to teach boxing. But at the same time, they're learning some other things aware of that are related to self-defense. So you'll find me there. You'll start seeing me post some things online as far as content material. But for the most part, I have not done the social media thing. I just didn't get it. To me, I thought it was like very, very self-serving. But now I kind of get the social media thing now. So I'm going to start to kind of do that and kind of put some stuff out there and put some content out there.
Awesome, man. And, you know, I watched you as a baby at UFC 1. You know, I'm a big fan of that entire generation, how you guys put the, you know, the sport and the future of the sport on your backs. And you went out there and went to war. And, you know, it's a huge honor to talk to you, Zane Frazier. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm a big fan. And, you know, thank you for all that you've done for the sport and continue to do for the sport.
Thank you for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Yes, have a good one. Wow. Can't talk to Mr. Zane Frazier from UFC 1. Crazy. Awesome.
Great show. Very educational.
So educational. Like, some of the things I was saying was blowing my mind, and you can see my reactions, but I was like, holy shit, you know, like, man, stories for days. And I thank him very much for coming on the show. A couple of plugs before we wrap this up like a Christmas present. I'll be commentating for Flex Fight Series 16th. No, not the 16th, I believe the 18th. So, well, what's the date this Friday, sir?
What's that?
What's the date for this Friday? Oh, the 18th.
18th.
Yeah, 18th. If you want to watch me back on color commentating, back on calling some great fights in the New York City area, go on flexfights.com, order the pay-per-view at 6 p.m. Eastern this Friday, and hear me on color commentating, calling some incredible fights. And also, I am back on color commentating for June 26th. For ECF Back with a Vengeance on Fight Plant pay-per-view. Go on Fight Plant TV to order the pay-per-view and hear color commentating from me and 12 amazing fights. My beautiful girlfriend's going to be there. All my friends are going to be there watching from Queens, New York. If you've gotten tickets, we're almost sold out at M0.
What's the pay-per-view cost?
Pay-per-view costs, I believe, $19.99. So you're going to get 12 fights for only $19.99. That is incredible.
Does Fightmaster have a promo code for that?
I believe they're setting it up right now. But, you know,
I'll get them to
get that up and running, I promise. But, you know, go on Fight Plan TV, June 26th. Hear me back on color commentating in the beautiful state of New York. I'm sure Matt loves New York. You know, we talk about all the time from Florida. But hear me on color commentating. June 26th for ECF and June 18th for Flex Fight Series on flexfights.com. So order the pay-per-view. And this show is brought to you by Drenger Nutrition. Be sure to go on drengernutrition.com to order all supplements. You know, they work like a charm. They're tasty. Mix it up with milk. Mix it up with water. Get jacked. Get swole, bro. Go on drengernutrition.com and visit our incredible sponsor. Also, Katja MMA and Fitness. Gabe is not here tonight, but go to Katja MMA Fitness for you want to train with a 4-time world champion, Mr. Gabe. Go to Tarzana, California for Katja MMA and Fitness and tell him that the Fight Mixer sent you. So, Matt, the producer, any final words or what's going on for next week's shows?
Yes, we are going to be having Jason Reinhardt on.
Oh, beautiful.
He's going to be in a documentary about After the Cage type things with Ooh. Matt Hughes and a couple other people. So
awesome.
Looks pretty interesting.
Right on.
Yep. So other than that, no, I don't have anything to say.
I'm hyped to the tits, and we're going to have great shows lined up next week for the ladies show on Wednesday. Be sure to check that out. Go on Amazon, go on Roku, go on Apple TV, go on illegal streaming. Just fucking watch it. Don't break my balls. And then go on next Sunday for Bare Knuckles Most Wanted and also Fight Mixer TV. We got some great shows lined up. So, boys and girls, children of all ages, all my bros and hoes in different area codes with swollen nipples, thank you very much for joining us for this edition of Fight Mixer. Thank you so much, Zane Frazier, for coming on and dropping some knowledge. Boys and girls, we'll see you next week. Peace.
Perfect. Perfect. Perfect.